Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight and to the Sydney Institute, and thanks to Westpac for the use of this fine facility. It's the first time we've been here, and it's appropriate that David Morgan's addressing us here. But could I just remind everyone to turn off their mobile phones if they haven't already done so? And this, of course, is our first function for 2008. And the program, I think, is on the chair. So I'll introduce our speaker briefly. David Morgan studied at La Trobe University in Melbourne, the London School of Economics, and at Harvard University. He worked in the International Monetary Fund. He then became a career official in the Australian Federal Treasury, working in a number of areas, but of course financial deregulation around the turn of 1980 and tax reform in the early 1980s. He was Deputy Secretary of the Treasury Department in 1989 and came to Westpac in 1990 and was Chief Executive Officer at Westpac from 1999. So he's well equipped to talk about his background in the public and private sectors, and the topic is Reflections on a Life in the Economic Fast Lane. David Morgan, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Jared. So, here I am at the end of 18 years, and I have to confess that I have a credibility problem. It doesn't seem credible to me that I'm leaving, that my time is up, and that I'm out the door. It does seem just the other day that I joined the company. But for that matter, it does also seem just the other day that I took my last money box to the Malvern branch of the Bank of New South Wales. You keep your head down and you do your best. And when you look up, well, it's time to go. I will say that much about myself. I've kept my head down and I've given it everything I could. The trouble was, I had this thing about succeeding. People talk about the devil driving. Well, that's what I had, a sort of demon. I didn't exercise it, but then I didn't especially want to. It's like that, of course. So I decided to give in to him and to do what came naturally. I might not have been, indeed certainly wasn't, Adam Smith or John Maynard Keynes, but they weren't either until they put in the hours. Who knows, I thought, I might go to the next level. So I started working hard one day, and I've never really stopped. In fact, I don't know how I'm going to stop now. I have been very lucky. I've always known that. Being born in this country and growing up in the 50s and 60s was the first great stroke of luck. Being raised in modest circumstances, I count as a second stroke. It nourished my competitive instincts and thus fitted me for the new economy. Going to a new university with a meritocratic ethos and a couple of brilliant teachers, that was the third part of my luck. Economics was the fourth part. I fell in love with the subject. There's no luckier person than one with a vocation. Economics became mine, and it sustained me all my life. I'll jump over the other bits of luck that I had on the way to joining Westpac, except for one, because in a way that I sometimes find uncanny, it actually became part of the same story. And that luck was to join the Federal Treasury at the beginning of a golden era of reform. I joined in the early 1980s, around the time the Campbell Report recommended deregulating the Australian financial system. I was put in charge of the task force to consider that report's recommendations, and then I struck a government with the courage and the zeal to implement them. I think about it sometimes. Had I joined the Treasury at any other time in the past century, chances were I could have slept through much of my time there. But I struck a decade of quite exhilarating reform and dedicated reformers. It was a time when we felt as if we were remaking the country, and in fact, we were. I also struck great talent and great characters, both in the department and in the cabinet. People who shared my passion for work and for economics, and it's not too much to say, for Australia. That's how I was lucky. It's always lucky to be there at the creation. Or the resurrection. Which brings me to Westpac. When I joined Westpac in 1990, the bank was falling to its knees, and shortly thereafter, Kerry Packer and Al Dunlop were waiting to deliver the coup de grace. The oldest company in Australia, the company that had been such a vital part of Australia for all the 29 years of the nation's history, almost fell into the hands of Al Dunlop. It's what happens when you think you know all there is to know. It's what hubris can do to you. Westpac got deregulation wrong. It got it wrong because many of the people running Westpac weren't equipped for it. The wrong ideas, the wrong reading of the times, and the wrong ethos. They thought deregulation meant a free-for-all, where a bank could choose to play any games in any field it chose, regardless of comparative advantage. They thought nearly 170 years of success guaranteed ongoing success. But the fundamental point about deregulation was the opposite of this. The point was that past protections were gone and you had to get better, much better, at your core business. But it was the core business that Westpac abandoned prematurely. The new Australian economy demanded quite profound changes in the previously heavily regulated banking industry. The story of Westpac's recovery and growth is primarily a story of these changes. The demanding and sometimes fraught circumstances of their conception, their painful birth, their often laborious implementation. Things were happening in the new economy that provided opportunities for banks with eyes to see, and they were happening in core business areas. For example, there was an unmistakable sign that the future of household savings no longer lay primarily with bank deposits, but rather with superannuation and a whole new wealth-building industry. The other thing demanded by the deregulated economy was that merit be recognised, be very fully recognised. The irony of deregulation was that 7 or 8 years in, government was still leading and business was still lagging behind. It was still trapped in the habits and the certainties of the pre-regulated world. Not to put too fine a point on it, it was being strangled by the old school tie and the received wisdom of that ancient hegemony. As it happened, I'd had to hand in my old school tie as a 10-year-old when my father went broke and the bank sold the house out from under us. So I suppose I was well suited to the deregulatory environment. I had the personal incentive and the right work habits. And work we did. In the early 1990s, the company was in crisis. In the space of just 6 months, the chief executive, the chief operating officer, the chairman and four other board members had resigned or been sacked as the price for a badly botched response to the deregulated financial system was brought to account. In these necessitous circumstances, I was put in charge of a team with responsibility for about two-thirds of the bank, and we set out on an urgent recovery program. The team voluntarily cancelled all their Christmas leave, and we ramped up our performance targets. We worked day and night, 7 days a week. I don't know if our efforts saved the bank. A number of people were kind enough to say they did. I don't know if that's true, but I do know for sure that we proved what the right people with the right motivation can do in business. I'd seen it in the public sector, and I now saw it in the private. I've no doubt that everyone who was in that team took from it a new or renewed faith in what deeply committed teams can do. And if I was to nominate a business value to come out of that experience, it was a belief in people and the imperative to invest in them. When I went to head the institutional banking group in the second half of the 90s, I took this belief with me, and the team we assembled then became the team that led the bank as a whole when I became chief executive in 1999. In that year, Bob Joss, to his immense credit, announced a record profit for Westpac. The bank had very plainly survived. But we'd survived at a fearsome cost. Our shareholders were tolerably content, but our staff had paid a price in sweat and tears. Thousands, in fact tens of thousands, had been laid off. And too many of the thousands that remained were demoralised, disenfranchised and alienated, though perhaps not quite as alienated as our customers. Our customers thought we, along with the rest of the major banks, were greedy, arrogant, contemptuous and ignorant of their needs. Communities felt the same way. As they saw it, banks had taken deregulation to mean that their only responsibility was towards their shareholders. Politicians were objects of love and devotion compared to the big banks. In short, we had lost the trust and the confidence of most of our key stakeholders. What's more, a second look at the financial results showed they were based not on expansion, but shrinkage of our market share. In the prolonged effort to recover from near extinction and to meet the challenges of the newly deregulated environment, the burgeoning global economy, the unprecedented levels of competition, the new technologies, just surviving had become an end in itself. It had become a culture of survival. The oldest company in Australia had survived, but had few plans for its future. It had become a bit like the dog that chased the bus. It caught the bus, but what to do with it? Unlike the dog, we couldn't retire panting to our front yard. This was the deregulated world, and our old front yard was everybody else's as well. I began by talking about my good luck. There have been 23 CEOs of Westpac in 190 years. That's an average of about 8 years for each one. The odds are stacked against being in the right place at the right time to get the job. But I got it. I had one thing going for me. I knew the bank and all of its operations very well, having run each of them over the previous 9 years. I'd seen it at the bottom, and I'd been there through the recovery. For me, that May 1999 result was proof of the need to set a new course. Those financials could not be sustained into the future unless we restored the basic ingredients of a decent business. So there were two great tasks to be undertaken in 1999. We needed to define a real future for the bank, and we needed to rebuild the faith of our staff, customers, and the community. The first task meant building Westpac's share in the burgeoning wealth sector and capturing the enormous opportunity presented by compulsory private superannuation. It meant a departure from the strategies that had led the bank into perilous difficulties, into risk-prone businesses and markets that were not well understood. The steps we took instead, acquiring and rejuvenating BT, Rothschilds and Hastings, calling out the shift in household savings, setting bold goals for the company in the superannuation revolution, were the most important strategic steps the company's taken in its recent history. The second task was to restore trust and respect. The banks had been regarded as pillars of the community. They were now pariahs. When I say pillars, I don't mean they were loved or regarded as much better than niggardly. But they were generally trusted and grudgingly respected. The erosion of faith in the banks was particularly startling in a company that had lasted for the best part of two centuries. Westpac had evolved in parallel with the country's society and economy. It survived depressions, recessions, wars, and attempts at nationalisation. The deregulation that nearly killed it, in the space of half a decade or so, two centuries of goodwill had gone down the drain. If we wanted the bank to last for another two decades, let alone another two centuries, we needed to restore the goodwill. Without it, we were not sustainable. The community was right. Shareholder value had become the mantra of big business. Business should look after the shareholders, and the government should look after the people. This was a big mistake. And a particularly glaring one in the case of a bank, not just a bank, but Australia's oldest company. As we laid the basis of the new culture at Westpac, we were also relaying some of the traditional foundations. We were recognising that we're a bank, not a clothing company or a factory. And whether they put their savings in them, or finance their businesses through them, or work for them, or live with them in the community, people expect banks to behave like banks and act in their interests. Restoring trust began with the people who worked for Westpac. Where else could it begin? The history of Westpac's last 30 years is the history of a very old company in a very old sector of the economy, coming to terms with not just the deregulated Australian economy, but an economic and technological revolution without precedent in scope and speed of change. The task of rebuilding the faith of our employees and our customers was made that much harder by those two intertwined revolutions. It had to be done in the face of momentous and unceasing change that, even as it created prosperity, also created deep uncertainty and put unprecedented pressure on the lives of working people. I know I'm not the only person in business to discover that just as you couldn't make the changes the company needed to make without the company's people, you can't tell the story of success without acknowledging their trust. I mean trust that you care about them, that you listen to them, that it's safe to speak up, that you care about what they think and value and believe. Engendering a direct, high-trust relationship with our people, with enthusiasm, loyalty, and self-belief, where there be none of these things, has been, I think, perhaps the company's most significant and valuable achievement. Valuable because such employees are more efficient and productive. You draw from them more discretionary effort. Employees who enjoy coming to work work more effectively than employees who don't. If they like their work, if they're rewarded on merit, regardless of gender, race or ethnicity, if the company's values align with their own, and if they're proud of the company they work for, they'll work harder, they will essentially manage themselves and stay longer with the company. And for the company, these are huge advantages. In recent years, we've worked hard to establish a much more open culture in which people are free to speak their minds and challenge the way things are done. We've worked particularly hard at leadership and teamwork. I've spent a lot more time than I ever imagined talking and listening frequently and directly to the 2,000 leaders of our 28,000 strong staff. The success of Westpac in recent years has been built on this kind of cultural change. These were the analytical foundations of business that for more than a decade Westpac, and indeed business in general, had needed to discover. We set about building a trustworthy, responsible, and ethical organisation. Values that simultaneously met the needs of our organisation and of the people that we wished to attract and retain. This objective was at the heart of our corporate responsibility and sustainability program, which I have to tell you has become not just a source of great pride within the company, but an essential part of the bank's culture, brand, and strategy. In fact, the most recent chapter in Westpac's history might well be called The Road to Sustainability. If you ask what I learned from the last 18 years or so, it was much as I learned in the decade before that. But given clear and worthwhile goals, respect, a voice, aligned values, and proper rewards, people can and will do remarkable things. For people used to the language of business and economics, these are soft-sounding words. Just as improving childcare and maternity and paternity leave and sustainable business practices are soft-sounding initiatives. But I think we've demonstrated beyond question that these things build shareholder value. I'd say the same about the work we've put into making merit a core principle in the company. And the directly related fact that we have raised the number of women in management positions from 25% in 1999 to 43% now. Similarly, we've lifted the number of mature age workers, I've recently become one, and the proportion of our workforce born outside Australia. And we're working at building skills in Indigenous communities and employment opportunities for the disabled. We've surveyed the attitudes of our employees, and for us, it makes satisfying reading. In short, more of our employees are more committed to the company than at any time in the last decade. And the figures show that these are the highest of any large company in Australia. There is, of course, another great benefit in all this. In our business, employees are literally inseparable from customers. To our customers, our employees are the bank. Because customers don't trust companies, they trust people. The underpinnings of a successful brand in our business is most often a matter of human connection. Only humans have passion. Only humans have integrity. And our customers will judge the credibility of our brand in large part by the values of our people. There's a direct correlation, if you like, between loyal employees and loyal customers. And it's in that correlation that shareholder value substantially lies. As I said, we realised that to succeed in the modern, rapidly changing world, we had to look to our past. We had to become a bank again, and I think we have. We became a preferred employer. We became the number one bank in the world and one of the foremost companies in Australia for sustainable practices. We became a good citizen. We managed broad and we managed long. And we did this because it's good business to do it. It's good for shareholder value. It's good, in fact, it's essential for the long-term interests of the bank and banking. The results of all the foregoing are plain to see. The highest employee commitment engagement of any large company in Australia. Record levels of customer satisfaction. Ranked as the leading bank in the world or equal leader for sustainability in the past 6 years. And a sector-leading combination of growth and returns sustained for most of the past decade. But what is more significant than these figures is a permanent and sustainable transformation of the company. Deregulation brought new responsibilities with the new freedom. The old dictum that business only has to manage business and government manages the rest no longer applies. Over the past 35 years or so, power has shifted quite dramatically from the public to the private sectors. But if we in the private sector do not exercise it conscientiously, our license to operate will be at risk. In a democracy, it doesn't pay to take the people for granted. And what can be deregulated can be re-regulated. All it takes is a wave of popular discontent. They say that opportunity springs from adversity. And no doubt that's true enough, but I wouldn't want to rely on it. What I think may be said more reliably is that adversity very often contains lessons, and there are rewards for those who are willing and last long enough to learn them. For the truth is that some things can only be learnt from experience. So long as they're the right things, and not the only things that you know or care to believe. It's clear to me now that the troubles Westpac went through had the ultimate benefit of driving management to reach the depth of understanding and dedication to remake the company as thoroughly as it had to be remade. I'm also aware that Westpac struggled to survive. Served my own career at the bank. I learned more, a lot more, than I would have otherwise, and I believe that I achieved more because of what I learned. I think all of us who went through those times and survived into the new centuries were wiser and stronger for the experience. Above all, I think we learned not to trust fashionable mantras, especially those that originate in hierarchies. But in conclusion, here are a few mantras of my own. Nothing fails like success. As inflation is to an economy, hubris is to management. Beware the cancer of arrogance. That's why the culture of a company matters more than we ever thought a decade or so ago. Working on the culture of the place, questioning the way it works and the way it thinks, and especially what is taken for granted, is the only cure for hubris. It's thus a defence against calamity, as well as a major source of comparative advantage. And one more mantra of mine: the four pillars can't stand forever. Indeed, they can't stand for much longer. To believe that they can, or that they should, is like believing that centaurs can and do exist. It's a lovely idea, but impractical in the modern world. Much that I've learned, that Westpac has learned, mirrors the experience of business everywhere. We have been fortunate enough to live not just in a long boom, but a period of prolonged change, some of it brought about by courageous governments, some beyond all our abilities to control. To have been near or at the centre of all of this has made my life a profoundly privileged one. It feels as if I picked up a thread the first time I walked into an economics lecture with Professor Donald Whitehead at La Trobe University in 1967, and I've followed the thread ever since. From Maynard Keynes to Milton Friedman, to John Stone and Chris Higgins, and Bernie Fraser and Ted Evans and Paul Keating, to Westpac and Bob Joss, John Urich, Leon Davis, and Ted Evans again. All the great people of the board and with whom it's been my privilege to work at the bank these past 18 years. Good boards, good chairman, and good colleagues are priceless and indispensable and can never be taken for granted. And I sincerely hope that I never did or never seem to. This story I've tried to tell tonight is a story of business, economics, and to some extent politics. But it turns out to be principally a story of people. People of ability, perseverance, vision, and goodwill. And of course there's a lesson in that for business and for economists and for politicians. Bob Joss, who was my predecessor in this job, said to me last year that what impressed him most about Westpac in 2007 was the respect in which it was held. And it's true. Westpac today is a company conscious of its past and proud of it. It's also conscious of its future and confident about it. But above all, I hope and believe it's a company in tune with the needs and the spirit of the present age. For nearly two centuries, Westpac's story has weaved in and out of Australia's story. The two are in fact inseparable. It's true of the bank's first 30 years and profoundly true of the last 30. To have been part of that, to have participated in the drama of it, I count as one of the great privileges of my privileged life. It's a good story, and I've had a good time telling it, Bill Clinton writes at the end of his autobiography. Well, this is my story, and I've had a wonderful time in the thick of it. Thank you.
Many thanks, David Morgan. So we come to questions and discussion, we finish, of course, no later than 7 o'clock, and thanks to Westpac again for this facility. I first came across David Morgan in, I think, December 1984. I think the Australians here today, they may be interested in this story, because I was working for John Howard, who was Deputy Opposition Leader and Shadow Treasurer, and believe it or not, John Howard took a Freedom of Information action against the Treasury Department to get budget papers that Paul Keating as Treasurer wouldn't give him. And when that was knocked back by the Treasury, John Howard appealed to the Minister of Appeals Tribunal, and David Morgan represented the Treasury Department. We didn't get the documents, but then Labor didn't get the documents when John Howard was Prime Minister either. So
you can have them now, Jim.
But can I ask, you've reflected on life in the economic fast lane. What about life in the political fast lane as well? I mean, you mentioned Paul Keating tonight, but what was he like to work for? Because he is in the public service, of course, because he was obviously one of the most interesting figures in Australian political history. Can you reflect a bit on Paul Keating?
I had the privilege to work for a number of treasurers, but the two main ones I worked for was John Howard, who you also, of course, worked with, and Paul Keating. I must say it was a very exciting experience to work for Keating. He was someone who had a very alert intelligence. He was not university trained. In fact, I think he left school probably with the leaving certificate. But had a passion to learn the framework of economics and public policy, and had a very alert intelligence. He also had a real desire to make a difference, and he had the political skills to get that through cabinet. So all in all, it was a very exciting experience to work with him.
Michael? David, your passion for reform, can I take you back to the Treasury when you led the response to the Campbell Committee?
Yes.
Was there a similar passion for reform in Treasury at the time? And I ask you that in view of the Treasury response to the Vernon Committee report of some years previously, which was very negative.
Yes. Thank you, Michael. Michael, my first, probably the first time I came to the attention of the senior, most senior levels of Treasury was when I, in fact, joined in 1971. And the first thing I did was to write a note to, I think, the Secretary of the Treasury at the time, saying that their criticism of Vernon was at best incompetent, at worst dishonest. And I thought, well, this will probably make for a fairly short career in Treasury. But as it was, John Stone hauled me into his office and we had a spirited debate and a close professional relationship for years thereafter. I think there was that zeal in the early 80s when I rejoined the Treasury, and I think we also had a treasurer at the time, namely John Howard, who was prepared to seek to carry those reforms in. As it was, that came very late in the Fraser government, and it wasn't long after that we got Campbell that, in fact, there was a change of government. I think there'll also be a question that probably not to be addressed today, but you know, whether John Howard at that time had the same full-blooded support from his Prime Minister as Paul Keating enjoyed with Bob Hawke, and I probably just should leave that alone.
There's a question, then we go to Maxwell.
Yes, you just argued for the removal of the Four Pillars policy, yet on the other hand said you like being receiving the sort of, you know, economic sort of contribution. Most economists basically argue that competition is good for good savers. The Four Pillars seems to argue against this policy. How do you reconcile these two views? A good economist would say, don't reduce the amount of competition. Yet you, as a good economist, are saying reduce it.
Look, I am a great believer that opening the Australian economy to the forces of competition from both the domestic and foreign sources has been the single most important thing that has lifted this country from being one of the most sclerotic in the OECD economy to one of the most dynamic. So let me agree with that premise. I think we have a good competition policy in this country. I think we have a very good competition policy in this country. So the onus of proof for me is to say, why is that competition policy, which has served every other sector of the economy so well, why will that not serve the banking sector well? We have a competition policy there. We have a referee, and the referee should be allowed to opine on it for the banking sector as for any other. Yes, banking is different, and that's why we have a prudential policy. But the onus of proof would be on those who would say that this competition policy that served us so well that somehow banking should be insulated from it. I also happen to think it is very bad for competition and for efficiency and for management sharpness to be protected from being taken over from its next most alternative owner. So I think it's actually anti-competitive.
Max Welsh.
David, let me ask you a question about the present. And your position as an ex-banker.
I've still got 2 weeks to go, Max. Don't get me out the door just yet.
The point is that we're living at the moment through a financial crisis in the financial markets. One which threatens to spill over into the real economy on a global scale. But nobody doubts where its genesis was in the financial markets, particularly amongst the major players. I ask you, do you recognise and accept this? One of the problems here is there's a basic imbalance and mismatch between performance and reward for managers. The performance lasts, the CEO may only have a short life, 3 or 4 years, during which he does, as the former CEO of Citibank said, you keep dancing till the music stops, meaning that you just maximise returns in the short run. But nevertheless, the memory lingers on afterwards. If your management reward is paid for in your short time at the top. But we pay for what's left behind. Do you see that as a problem? You don't think it's a problem, you think the market will solve it if it is a problem.
Mm. I think there are certain aspects of reward system, Max, that do reward short-termism. I also think that there are mechanisms by which one can avoid the worst excesses of that through exactly what one is incented for and the way one is incented. So if I just take my own example, and I've been a CEO for 9 years, so I don't regard myself as a short-term CEO, nor do I regard the objectives that I've pursued as primarily or even only short-term financials. I've always been measured against a set of a balanced scorecard around the needs of our customers and our people, as well as our shareholders and the community. And more than half of my remuneration was in terms of long-term incentives that depended on the long-term performance of the company. So while undoubtedly there are excesses, I also think there are mechanisms to get around them. And I think we've done a tolerably good job in this company of doing that.
Well, do you see those excesses as functionally related to the current price?
Look, Max, I think it's been one of the factors, but I think it is the current issues are multi-causal. So it's been one of the factors, but only one of the factors. I think it's been many, many different causal factors at work.
There's a question here.
Good evening, Mr. Morgan. I just wonder, what's the main role of the non-bank institutions today, and will they be positively managed in the future? That's our question.
In terms of non-bank financial institutions, that's a very broad sector, and includes sectors like the general insurance sector and other parts that just haven't sat naturally with the traditional mandate of banks. So I think there is absolutely a role for parts of the non-bank financial services sector. There have been other parts of the non-bank financial services sector that have only grown up as creatures of regulation, and that is that you had heavy regulation around the banking sector, which created regulatory arbitrage, so institutions would set up just outside that ring of regulation with a non-neutral playing field. Now, I think the deregulation of the Campbell Report did a lot to kill those so-called creatures of regulation, of which many of them were the finance companies that grew up in this economy. So those that are the creatures of regulation, I think, don't have a future, and those that are discrete segments that banks can't serve properly, I think, will sustain themselves.
You're familiar with today's problem, the economic problem in America. To what extent are the banks responsible? If they are not responsible, who or what is responsible?
Yeah. The causes of the problem in the U.S. are again multi-causal. Of course, it started with the subprime, but it quickly spread to a correction of some fundamental underpricing of risk that goes on to some extent at the tail end of all bull markets. That institutions, notably banks, but not only, become insufficiently sensitized to risk and underpriced risk. And there are certain assets and segments and customers for which price risk is underpriced. So it became a much more pervasive phenomenon, of which certainly as far as the subprime concerned, the banks had a very major role. But it's also being brought to account where it should be brought to account. I mean, we've seen the number of bank CEOs with the losses brought to account of those banks, and those CEOs have been fired. We've also seen some excesses in the housing market that aren't just related to the subprime. I mean, America's had a monstrous boom in housing and a classic excess inventory of housing. That's not simply the bank's fault. So You know, they are now left with a large inventory of unsold housing, and bank and house prices have to go down to adjust that, and that will put a big crimp on private consumption, and that will be a major factor in the slowdown of the US economy. So banks have been important in all that, but they haven't been the only factor.
Thanks for a great presentation. Two components to my question. Looking back, what would you say is the secret to your success, and looking forward, what aspirations and plans do you have in the future?
Be lucky. That's a very important ingredient of success, and I've always been lucky. Choose your parents carefully. Work very hard, and choose the right partner.
Otherwise, it's getting big trouble.
Life wouldn't have been worth living without that. As for the next phase, I haven't made too many decisions at all, except the one I made a year ago, not to continue in full-time executive life. Secondly, I want to live in Australia. Thirdly, my wife and I have set up a charitable foundation, and she is chairman of the Breast Cancer Foundation, having been a previous sufferer, and that will take some of my time. I walk out of here next Wednesday night into my first board meeting. Boards are very quiet. That's BHP Billiton, which is going to be an interesting meeting. And I'm going to breed Australia's best stock horses. So if you're in the market for a stock horse, if I could see you at the end of the time.
David, this morning there was a report in the news about the name of the bank I've now forgotten, the Newcastle Bank in Britain. And what was interesting about it is as it sort of veers towards possibly crashing, the British government has decided to kind of bail it out. And the commentator, or whoever I was listening to, was talking about how, and it was something that you said in your own speech, from deregulation they're almost going back to nationalising the bank. Now, do you see this happening again? Because it's an interesting thought that after 70 years, or whatever it was, or you know, 70 years eventually, it is about nationalisation of the banks, we should be talking about nationalising banks in order to bail out shareholders. Is it, we're so caught up in this network in our economy that we may see this happen elsewhere.
I think you're talking about Northern Rock, are you? Was that said? Yes. Well, you're quite right in what you're reading at the moment. I think that's a backward step in my own judgment, and I think by the government going in to bail out poor risk decisions, I think that creates what we tend to call a moral hazard, and that is you just encourage people to be complacent about risk if the government's going to go in and bail out those institutions that have been careless about risk. So I think it's a very backward step, and I hope very much we don't see it here. For me, it's hard to give a short answer to that, but I will try. For me, sustainability is about managing for the long term, and not for the short term, because long-term shareholder value is the only one that matters. Secondly, it's about managing broad, by which I mean managing for each stakeholder group, because in our business, profits are really the outcome of loyal staff and committed staff and committed customers. So it's looking after those two stakeholder groups, as well as a fourth stakeholder group in the case of banks, and that is the community. Because in a democracy, the legitimate needs of the community ultimately get met. And if we don't meet them, then governments will legislate, and which is why I think re-regulation of banking was a real threat. The last element about about sustainability is around managing according to a set of values that meets the needs of the organisation and the needs of the people that you want to attract. Because I think Australia, the biggest constraint on its growth for the next 20 years is going to be a shortage of skilled labour, and there's going to be a real war for talent. And values are the glue that really knit the needs of people who essentially are very resistant to be managed, and to attract those people who basically self-manage. So the value comes through the reputational capital in the labour market and attracting, retaining those people, and the reputational capital with customers, as well as the direct benefits you can get just by managing one's emissions better, as well as also reducing regulatory risk. So I think all of those elements are part of the shareholder value equation.
David, you've talked a lot about people in your presentation this evening and the time that you spent with the 2,000 leaders in Japan. It's obviously more difficult to get to the breadth of the 28,000 that we've talked about. I wonder if you could give one or two examples of the sorts of things that you've been able to do to win the trust of the broader 28,000 and how they might describe the culture of Israel.
Okay. So you put your finger on a very real practical problem about how do you as a chief executive reach out individually to 28,000 people. So the major mechanism I have sought to do it is through the first line leaders, because those 2,000 people that I've spent so much time with are actually the most important person in the company to those other 26,000. They have the greatest impact on those people. And so it's trying to get those 2,000 people, as you like, as me and my team's representatives out there. However, in addition to that, I do have an open line once a month to all employees who anybody in the company can call me. I also have websites that people can come directly into my office, and they can do it either identifying themselves or completely confidentially. And I also get as much time out in the field as I can through the constraints of the tyranny of the corporate diary to spend time with the people who really know what's going on in your company, and that is frontline staff. But the transmission mechanism via first line leaders is really important, and it's been effective.
Question for you. David, thanks for a great presentation. As a couple of other guests mentioned, the markets have shown us bugs recently. I was wondering if you might be able to draw a comment on your own personal leadership attributes that you focus on in the past to really talk you through some difficult times so that you might be able to learn from those experiences.
It's interesting how my notion of what a bad day or a tough time at work has changed while I've been in the job. Early on, a bad day would have been a bad analyst report or bad press report or a board member giving you a clip around the ear over something. And it's very interesting that as I've gone on, it's been less about those things, because you know yourself whether you're doing a good job or not. You care a lot less about what others might be writing or saying about you. And it's more particularly focused on people issues, the one that one has really had a challenge with a team member that might be going through a tough time personally, or performance issue, or some being out of line with the team. So it's been very interesting to me about how the notion of what tough times, what the tough challenges are. In terms of other qualities, quote unquote, I mean, on the one hand, you need to have a fairly thick skin, so as not to be oversensitive to those elements, but not so thick that you don't care about people, because those 28,000 people actually really know whether you really care about them or whether you're faking it. So again, like most things in life, it's a question of the right balance. The other thing is having a good team around you, and there's virtually no problem that I don't think can be solved, that can't be solved if you get it onto the table in an open and honest way quickly. So promoting an open culture and a culture of teamwork means that you're not taking all of that problem solving onto your own shoulders, because the fact is, in large corporations, there is very little that a CEO can get done alone.
Question down the back, and then there's a question over here. Yes.
Thank you for a good presentation. You mentioned this evening a bit of information transparency and economic and soft data. Yet the current
case also for lack of information transparency in the derivative market. So as a bank, how do you train off the need for information transparency, including risk management, versus less information being shared with the market as part of a competitive advantage set given the type of financial engineering?
That's a very good question, and there's no easy answer to it. My own view is that in solving the liquidity crisis that we've had, information has been paramount. When investors really went on strike in the wake of the subprime, and their response was quite disproportionate to the size of the shock, and they literally went on strike. And while the Fed tried some circuit breakers and the Treasury tried to think up some schemes, they had rather little effect, and what has had effect is transparency and disclosure, as we have seen where these subprime loans are, how they've been bundled up, who's holding them, how they've been marked to market, and that has seen a return. We're not there yet, but you know, spreads over LIBOR in the US now are 20 basis points over LIBOR rather than 100 basis points. So I think it is transparency and information that is necessary for efficient markets, and I think that should be the thrust of regulation. I think it should be the thrust of our own processes. And I think one of the casualties coming out of this is going to be those who really bundle up risk in a very complex and opaque way. I think investors will be much shyer now of taking on those bundles of assets with bundles of risk that they don't understand.
Second last question, John.
Yes. Australia is a small part of the world economy. Do you see Australian banks in the future to get growth of influence into the world more and more, setting up in China and India and other countries? What's your vision of that?
My vision is that there's a even more certain source of growth for banks, and that is in the wealth revolution that's going on in this country, and for banks to be able to properly intermediate household savings, not merely in the form of household bank deposits, but household superannuation. It's superannuation that's now twice as large as bank deposits and growing at twice the rate. And that is a phenomenal growth opportunity right in our own backyard. I think there are opportunities for Australian banks offshore, but I think they need to be firmly rooted in some form of comparative advantage that can allow you to go offshore and take on well-entrenched local banks and in national banks that might have been there for 100 years. So I think that you have to be clear-eyed about that source of comparative advantage, which I think is principally if there's an Australasian leg to the activity. So an Australian corporate doing business in Asia, an Asian corporate doing business in Australia, a trade flow, a goods flow, a services flow, a migrant flow, a capital flow. That's, I think, where is the true source of comparative advantage. Australian banks have found it hard to take a comparative advantage offshore. Same has been true vice versa. I was with Paul Keating in February 85 when he handed out 16 foreign bank licences to the 16 then and arguably still finest retail and commercial banks in the world. And the conventional wisdom then was in 20 years they will have wiped the floor with the Aussie banks. Well, here we are now, we're 22 years on, and they came and had a go, and they are out there, but it is very hard to take a home country comparative advantage offshore in banking.
Just a final question. Early in your career, you advised on some of the important economic reforms that were implemented. Now, at this stage of your career, if you had gratuitous advice to offer, what further reforms would you suggest? You've mentioned the four pillars, but what else would be on your mind if you're in a position now that you were in a position 25 years ago?
Well, I'm a bit rusty, Jared, on all of that, but I certainly think continuing progress on microeconomic reform, a lot's been done, but that agenda is not over yet. We've still got a lot of regulation in the economy. Some of it effective, a lot of it not. So I think continuing the trend of the past 25 years in both with microeconomic reform, I think monetary policy is well entrenched, so preserving the independence of the central bank and making sure it's just a single target with a single instrument, and I also support the discipline around fiscal policy of a balanced budget through the cycle. So I think a lot of the work's been done on macroeconomic reform, more to do on microeconomic reform.
Many thanks. I know there were some other questions in the room, but it's right on 7 o'clock, and so we finished. Look, I'll be very brief. David Morgan has been a key player in government and the economy over the past quarter of a century, both in his time in the Treasury and other places, but also in more recent years at Westpac. Dr. Morgan today told an important story of his involvement in these matters. It's great that he gave it to the Sydney Institute. It'll be a privilege for Anne to run it in the Sydney papers when it gets published in due course. So to David Morgan, many thanks tonight for telling a story in a very informative and interesting way. Thank you. And thanks for a great lot of questions, folks, and discussion.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.